Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Hello, hello. Hey, this is The Morning After. I am Jason Colucci here with a array of guests. I feel like I'm actually on a boat heading into Ellis Island, and it's 1903 with all the ethnicity that's in the room, myself included. I'm really excited about the show. This is actually where I wanted The Morning After to go to, just be an entire variety show of different personalities, chefs, political entities, anything you know that involves food, because there's a lot of different things, and food starts in a lot of different areas of at legislation, especially in our country. So I'm excited about our guest. Our first guest is going to be a call-in gentleman named Pat LaFrieda from Pat LaFrieda Meats. Pat.
Hello, Jason.
Hey, man, thanks a lot. First of all, congratulations on that new app. You guys were the top downloaded app for the iPad last week, the Pat LaFrieda Interactive Meat app, which is really cool. How did that all come about?
Well, we were trying to figure a way to fill the void. Over the last few years, that there's been a ton of desire to learn more about meat, and it was always amazing to me even how little chefs knew about what meat was out there and the different options there were for every species of meat. So making an iPad app to fill that void was possible through a partnership with 0.0 Production Company, and we were able to get almost every cut of meat possible onto an iPad app. And you saw the results. I mean, Apple made it App of the Week, and it's pretty exciting for like a little meat producer to be on the top of Apple's charts. It's really been a great week.
Yeah, I was at a dinner party about 3 weeks ago, and the woman that was putting all the food together, she had her iPad next to the stove, and she was going off of a recipe. And I know a lot of people that, especially just general consumers that go to the store, they're really intimidated by butcher shops, and sometimes there isn't sort of that neighborhood-friendly butcher, and there are cuts of meat that they want to... You kind of demystified. Do you set up all those photographs and stuff, or how does that whole thing go about to get to that point?
We did. I mean, it took almost a year to make this app, and we took thousands of photographs of meat. And anyone that's involved in photography could tell you that taking photographs of meat is the most difficult. And that's when we pulled Nick Solaris in from Serious Eats, and he did all the photography. And just to get the color tones correct, it's really a nightmare of a project. But when you say find butcher shops, yeah, there's been a reemergence in New York and in Brooklyn of little butcher shops. But that's, if you compare that to the nation, there are fewer and fewer neighborhood butcher shops to use as a resource anywhere in the country, and that's. Where we see people calling in from all around the country asking us meat questions and asking us if we could deliver the meat to them, because all they have are the local large supermarkets anymore, and very little of the meat that they carry is cut in that store. So even if you were to ask somebody in the meat department of a supermarket a question about the product that they had, they wouldn't know much about it because that's been prepackaged and cut someplace else. So the art form of butchering is it gets some press, especially in New York, but nationally it's a dying art, and
No,
with
you,
the app, it gives us the ability to get that information out there.
And you are one of the most knowledgeable people I've ever encountered in terms of just butchery. Because and people see you online and stuff, and they think that you have this glamorous life of being in Saint-Tropez or something. But your day starts at night and ends in the morning, essentially, right?
Yeah, I love the amount of email requests that I get of people that say, "Hey, I'm a Wall Street banker, and I want to do what you do. How do I go about doing that?" And just recently, I responded to somebody. It takes four generations of sweat. I work all night long, and for anyone that's come to the plant to visit, they'll understand how this is not a glamorous job, especially what I do. We're meat purveyors to restaurants. Essentially, we supply restaurants with meat. Restaurants, like you have Christian coming on next, I see,
yes,
from Cannibal. He'll tell you he wants his delivery in the morning at 7 a.m. In order to make that happen, 1,000 times over, we need to work all night to make that happen. And we're working in 34, 35-degree rooms all night long. It's not a glamorous job, but it's one. It's more of a culture to us, to me and my family. I was born in this business, just cutting meat with my dad since I'm 10 years old, and watching my dad and my grandfather cut meat, and just it was a natural way of life for me.
Well, Pat, you were talking briefly about people, the consumer buying stuff. Isn't there? They can go on the Pat LaFrieda website now and buy the Pat LaFrieda blend, chopped meat, and other stuff. How exactly should people approach that?
Yeah, we just started an e-commerce line because we had too many people from around the country asking us to send them product, and it wasn't possible. So we devoted a part of our new building to just e-commerce. So you're able to go on to the LaFrieda.com website, and there's a part, there's a place there where it says LaFrieda at Home, and you're able to order anything that we make to your house. So that's I'm a fourth-generation butcher from a third-generation company. This is the first time, as of a month ago, that you're able to do that.
Well, thank you, Pat LaFrieda. I know you're a very busy guy. I wanted to. We're going to take a break now. We're going to come back with the rest of our guests. This is The Morning After, and I am Jason Colucci.
Thanks for having me on, Jason.
Anytime.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied.
Thank you, Pat LaFrieda.
Clearly.
That was a, I went on the actual app, and it's so simple, these things. You know, you hop on and you're in a butcher shop, or you actually have a recipe at home, and you click on the thing, and it shows you what a tomahawk chop looks like, and what it comes from, what's it's actually supposed to be cooked for. And the thing is, Pat LaFrieda, I don't know if anyone's ever met him. He's a sweetheart. The guy works crazy hours, and I've never seen him in a bad mood dealing with crazy restaurant people like myself, maybe present company included. I'm going to go into our next interview now. This is a gentleman I met a few years ago during his first venture, Resto. And anyone's ever been to Resto, it's this greatly curated place with tons of beers. And they have, I would say one of my favorite things to do there is just have a couple of beers at the bar and have some French fries and just kind of hang out, because I have a lot of friends that work there. Christian Papanakalis, Nicholas. Christian Nicholas is here, and we're here to talk about his new venture, Cannibal.
Thanks, Jason. Yeah, I'll be, I don't want to be bold, but I'll say the Cannibal, only for the fact that we
it most people don't understand that the name has a sort of a brief history, and it's named after a famous Belgian cyclist. So he was nicknamed the Cannibal, and hence the reason why we don't ever preclude the from the name. But,
okay.
But thanks so much for having us, having me here, and our chef from the Cannibal's here as well, and
Michael Bernardino sitting to your left.
To my left, yeah.
So how did you had resto? You were there. Everybody was happy. You wanted to make your life even more insane, and you decided to open the Cannibal.
Yeah, if one's hard, two is going to be three times as hard. So I figured that would be the way to go. You know, it was just sort of it became a natural progression from what we were doing at resto. And you know, we've been open for about 4 months. Resto's been open for almost 5 years. And, you know, we've always subscribed to the whole animal mindset and very off-cut driven and very, we do a lot of large format feasts at Resto where you can order the whole pig, lamb, goat, veal, you know, yeti, if you will, like a couple weeks at a time. And that one takes a little bit longer, but to, you know, have sort of a nose-to-tail dining experience. And we didn't really have anywhere to break the animals down. And we're really, really passionate about a charcuterie program as well, in which case, like, you know, it was really about building something that supported that mindset. And I think like any other project, I mean, as you start to fantasize about it and then sort of, you know, put it down on paper, it grows and it sort of develops into something more. And it really developed into something that I think we're all really happy with and feel sort of special and fun and exciting. And you know, people have really sort of swarmed to it, so it's a great thing. We're really happy about it.
One of the first things when walking in the Cannibal is it's got its place in a lot of different areas. For one, you walk in and there's a huge selection of just beers. From everything from Delirium Tremonts to a 40 ounce of Miller High Life or something,
or Colt 45 actually.
Colt 45
yeah,
actually.
Absolutely.
Billy D. Williams, where you at?
Uh-huh.
And then you walk in and there's a bar. A traditional bar, gorgeous. There's the cycling stuff up there, hence the Cannibal. And then you walk into the back, and there's a butcher shop, but it's also a restaurant.
Right.
What was that a specific thing that you did, or it just kind of all fell into place after?
Well, I think you know, as I said, like, you know, when you start to conceptualize, you know, what you want to do, or you know, what you're trying to accomplish with something, I think it grows and. It grows out of necessity. I mean, it grows out of passion, but it grows out of necessity. And I think one of ours, you know, in the idea of sort of having these different pieces of it, you know, if we started with the butcher shop, you realize that you're going to butcher product for resto, and you're going to also butcher product for the retail aspect of it. But then when you think about product utilization, you say, well, I'm not going to get whole animals in here to, you know, to just like put it in the case and hopefully use it.
Yeah.
So we want to sell it in other ways, and you know, luckily we have somebody like Michael can, you know, create amazing pâtés and terrines and sausages out of things. So, you know, that plays the part of it, and with the beer aspect as well. It, you know, since we're allowed to sell at retail, it became a real fun way to do it, where you can, you know, as a diner, you can come in and sit and eat, and you can go and sort of pick your beers, you know, by looking at them, which. You know, for me, I'm such a visual person. It's so much fun to do that. And, you know, in the meat, it's the same way. You're sort of sitting there at the butcher counter having dinner, and you're like, I can sit down and look down and say, that steak is what, I mean, that's a 12, you know.
And you can do that, really.
Yeah, you can, you know, you can say
that's
like,
awesome.
You know, we'll kick back to Palafreda and say, that's a steak I'm getting this age for 12 weeks from Palafreda. Like, I want to eat that. And it's like, fired up and go, and where the sausages are pâtés. So, you know, it ties in that visual aspect of things, but it really crossed over and sort of worked out well for us, so.
Can you just go in and briefly talk about the nose-to-tail dining? Because I think people that don't dine out a ton and they want to book a party, they see that, they get a little intimidated. But it's actually, it's more fun, and in the long run, it's more inexpensive. It's cheaper, right, if you really look at it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as somebody that's so into food, and I'm sure everybody that's here right now can attest to, like, you know, my sensitivity to pricing when it comes to dining is not very high. I'm like, well, whether it's cheaper or not, I think that it's, you know, it's an experience that you just,
yeah,
that you get to have. You know, we started three years ago at Resto, and it really became something that I got to experience from a really, you know, pretty awesome restaurant that used to be in the city called L'Espinasse. And they used to do poularded in morning. It's an old classic French dish, and you take the black truffles and you slide it under the skin of the breast and the legs, and you're supposed to bury it in the ground and pour like champagne over it and this whole, you know, this whole thing. But you had to order it ahead. And, you know, I Christian Delouvier was a chef at the time. And I remember doing this in previous, you know, suit wearing, you know, industry that I was working in. And I thought, well, this is a great way for us to do this. You know, you can do this with a whole pig, and because you always wanted to do whole animals. I'm Greek, and, you know, by heritage, and we had lambs and goats and pigs all the time. And so what we do is basically you give, you know, with 2 week notice, you can order the animal, and these guys will break it down into not just like here's the pig, but you get, you know, 12, 14 preparations out of the animal. And so it really becomes that whole experience, which is sort of, for me, you know, it's like coming back storming the halls of Valhalla. Like, it's like, I just came back from conquering the castle. Like, I need to like feast and do that, you know, drink a big bottle of wine. Or.
And it's great when you get a whole animal delivery in, you know, and people walking to work, especially there in Murray Hill. you just, whoa, what's that about? But talk about how you got into the restaurant industry. You know, I understand you're Greek, and you guys, you're just genetically predisposed to go into that industry.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And rule it.
Absolutely.
How did that all happen?
I was born. That's all it took. That's all it took. Thankfully, Evan Papadakos, my father, was, you know, he came over and, well, I guess they started their own, he and his brother started their own restaurants in 1968 down in Delaware, and had them up until 1998. So after business school and being in commercial real estate for 5 years in the city, I tried to get out, but it sucked me back in. I guess somebody famous said that in a movie once, and it just, you know, I've always been passionate about it. I left commercial real estate. I went to French Culinary Institute for 6 months, cooked. It was really a vacation. It was like time for me to just to get out of the, you know, way of what I had been doing. And, you know, I luckily got to work for some really great people in the city and just sort of, you know, found my way until I decided I found a concept that I was really passionate about and wanted to do it. And that's it. I guess the rest is sort of.
But is there one specific restaurateur that you worked under? For myself, it's Drew Nipor and Keith McNally. Those are people that I've worked for, and I just wanted to work for. Is there anyone that comes?
Yeah, Jason Denton hired me at Enoteca. Well, Jason Denton and you know, Eric Kleiman and Joe Denton were the owners, and they hired me to Enoteca back in 2001, and that was sort of. I'd worked for a couple other places. I'd opened up a place as a manager with John Fraser and called Snack Taverna, and I'd sort of been begging to work at Lupa, which was always been one of my favorite restaurants in the city. And Jason had asked, you know, I finally, like, I think twisted his arm hard enough to get him to hire me. And you know, he's a really, really amazing guy to work for. He's an unbelievably successful restaurateur in the city, you know, and
sweetheart
and sensible and family man, and, you know, sort of all the things that I, you know, I'll aspire to be and, you know, in what I do. You know, so I worked for him there and then got a chance to go work over in Oto. And then I think at that point I sort of figured I'm, you know, about ready to do my own thing. And
well, we're going to go into a break now. Thanks, Christian. You're in studio now. We're going to go and talk to Chef Michael Bernardino a little bit later. Feel free to chime in at any time. This is The Morning After. I am Jason Colucci. We're back. Yeah. Rec. This is great. This is great. Like I said, we're on a cultural journey here at The Morning After. Laura Wirtz, 86list.com. Hot job of the week. Laura Wirtz, are you there?
I'm here. How are you, Jason? Let's see.
Let's
this week. Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. Let the Bone Thugs and Harmony kick in first.
Okay.
We'll fade it out. I know we didn't have it last week. Thanks. Well, Carlos did a good job, but he didn't have the actual lead-in. So we're a little bit off on our time. And this happens to the best of them. What's the hot job of the week? What's going on in the city? You know, I might be out there in the market next month, so I need to know what's up.
All right. Well, this week's hot job comes from the Breslin Bar and Dining Room. Of course, that's April Bloomfield's British Gastropub in the Ace Hotel. They are looking for a floor manager slash captain. The ideal candidate would have several years of experience in the hospitality industry. They would have a strong work ethic and a flexible schedule.
Do you think they'd hire anybody with a stewarding background?
I don't know. I think you should give it a try.
Oh, okay. No, I was just wondering. It sounded like, you know, Ken Friedman, righteous guy out there, opening places. Actually, shout out to Ken, Belinda Chang, and Chef Damon Wise for their two-star New York Times review. I know you worked with Damon for a little while.
That's right. That's amazing news. It's great to see that they could, do really well with the New York Times.
In such a short period of time as well.
That's right.
Thank you, Laura Wirtz. We'll talk next week. Laura Wirtz, 86list.com. Hot job of the week. I'm staring right now at a good friend, Chef Michael Bernardino from The Cannibal. I'm better with the Italian last names, I know. I'm sorry for everyone here. Chef, what's up, man?
Not much. How you doing?
I popped in there on Friday, and I just, Christian, hold your ears. I just kind of assaulted the kitchen. I went in the back with a couple of drinks. And,
I'm not going to ever hold my ears for that one. If you don't do that, I might have to kick you out.
And we were talking, and there's a gentleman. You were breaking down a chebo, a lamb, whatever continent you're on, whatever you want to call it. But talk a bit about the culinary side of The Cannibal and you see.
It's been interesting because we are trying to do retail butchering. We're trying to do a restaurant. We're trying to support another restaurant. And it's been a lot of just there's days where you set up your station and all of a sudden somebody comes in and wants to buy all your mise en place, which is a huge learning curve.
That's awesome. And can you tell what is mise en place for our regular listeners?
In this case it would be like, all right, well, we've just done a test run on a pate or terrine or like a batch of sausage, and it's just somebody walks in, you let them try something, and they're like, hey, can I get like 2 pounds of that? He was like, oh, if I had it, sure. But it's been fun, and it's a big learning curve than doing retail on top of operating a restaurant and supporting another restaurant, trying to like make sure that you usually in a restaurant you're butchering for your service. You know what's going to happen. And in this case, it's been just, all right, well, you don't know what's going to happen.
And when you say support, this is actually a brother and sister relationship. You guys are leaning each other in positive ways. It's not like, you know, one is subsidizing the other. This is actually a
No one's propping each other up. Yeah, it's just... We bring in all the animals for resto as well as ourselves, and we cut to what we need, which fortunately is off cuts. So it's like at the end of the day, you have pork chops and pork loins and lamb racks that are just like, all right, well, this is available for retail, which is generally what people would want. And we're using the necks and the legs and, you know, all the off cuts.
And your background is primarily in Italian. Is that a part of The Cannibal, or is it just sort of French and Italian and a little bit of everything?
There's a great cross section of European culture going on there, in that I have a very, very solid person working there right now with me, Alex, who is from Eastern Europe. He's German and Lithuanian, so he knows a ton of the stuff that I don't know, and he's always bringing stuff to the table to be like, hey, we should try doing this, we should try checking this out, we should look into this, and it's just throwing ideas off of a small group of great people. So it's fantastic in the sense that there's never any solid definition. It's not like Italian or French charcuterie. It's cross-cultural, and you know, we're doing a lot of things that are hopefully working out to represent all these different countries and doing it in an American way.
And when you talk about service there is a little different, because I mean, it's not your traditional, I mean, tickets are printing up, but there's like a garmanger, there's different sections. I mean, there's not a huge oven line there and stuff, which makes the place even more fun, because you know, if you're sitting at the bar and you walk in there, like, it's so cool. You can buy beer, like, to take home, you know. And then you go to the bar, you order a pint of beer just to kind of hang out. And then you can go to the station and have something to wait while you order a cut of beef. I mean, where else does this happen? And it's all top-quality stuff. Top quality from Christian's, you know, running place, you running the kitchen. Does that feel kind of schizophrenic to you, or does it feel organic?
Yeah, I think maybe.
There's definitely times where you're like, oh, wow, I don't even know if I can deal with this right now, because you have 10 people lined up on a Saturday night at like 7 o'clock trying to buy cuts of meat, and you're just like, yeah, just give me 1 second, I'll get rid. And we do a lot of custom cutting. We bring in animals, so it's like if somebody calls me and it's like, hey, I need a picnic shoulder. Like, no problem, give me 5 minutes, I have to go cut it. Which people have been very great with. It's like, you know, literally, here's an animal. Like, this is the animal you're going to get this shoulder out of.
Yeah.
And you just go cut it and bring it to them, and they've been, it's never been an issue. But there's definitely times where you're like, wow, I just don't know if I can do more right this second. And it's great, though.
But let's rewind for a second. We worked briefly at Polino's Bar and Pizzeria, and I've been doing this for, I don't know, 16 years, 17 years now, and I've worked with a lot of talented chefs, and I say this from the bottom of my heart, one of the top people I work talent-wise, Chef Michael Bernardino, was that something that, you know, talent kind of comes naturally, but was that something that was through your history, or did you have an affinity to cooking and kind of just grew more and more, you know, where did that all come from?
I started cooking when I was working in, you know, I was working as a back waiter in high school and just fell into cooking because it was just something to do to get me off the floor.
Yeah.
And I had somebody who was very influential in the fact that he was like, took me aside one day, was like, I don't know how this makes sense to you, but somehow it makes sense to you. You should just keep going with this. You can do this. Otherwise, I was pursuing archaeology and anthropology and a big history nerd. Like, that was it. So, through food, you get to go back and you get to learn about all of these things. And my background's predominantly Italian, so you get to bring that to the table with this. It's, you can go back and look at recipes from Apicius. You can go back and look at things that happened, you know, 14th, 15th, 16th century, and you can find these, you know, scriptures, the recipes and things, and you can take a little bit from that and put it to what you're doing today.
Well, we had Nathan Myhrvold on for Modernist Cuisine that wrote that book. Have you had a chance to take a look at that at all? Because you're talking about referencing history of cooking and stuff.
I have not had a chance to sit down with that book yet, and it's just been that we just opened, and it's just been so much going on since that book has come out, and it's just, my plate's full. I would love to sit down and actually spend a couple of days just pouring over it, because it's an amazing collection of stuff.
And there's three cities that that come up when I think about you. I think of New York City, I think of Detroit, and I also think of Boston. You've sort of been this nomadic kind of lifestyle. Is there any city that you give allegiance to in terms of your childhood?
It depends on the situations, because I did spend a lot of time in Detroit, but I really do feel like I'm from Boston. So, I mean, my influential years, like high school and stuff, was in Detroit. So you have to pay a certain homage to that, but also, like, being from Boston, you're born and raised. Like, definitely a Red Sox fan.
Don't punch me, but is Boston a restaurant town? Like, where do you put it up there in terms of food? And
stuff? They've got some amazing stuff going on. I mean, Coba's fantastic. Jamie Bissonette and Ken Orange are doing some awesome stuff up there. There's definitely some fantastic places. And, I mean, every week I hear about some new things. I had some friends go up there last week that fell upon a place, and they were just, like, super psyched about it, called me up, and were like, hey, you know, do you know anything about this? I was like, no, don't. But, I mean, in the spectrum of chefs up there, like Michael Schlau, Barbara Lynch, Ken Oranger, I mean, there's some amazing talent up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, there was a little bit less going on, but now there's another push going, and I think they're doing an awesome job up there. There's some fantastic places to go check out.
And the menu coming up for Christmas, I don't know if you guys are open Christmas or stuff, any different tweaks you guys going to do for the holidays?
New Year's Eve
is going to be a big blowout. We're just going to have it be a big butcher shop party and just kind of have people come in, have a bunch of, like, do a bunch of cold foods, do a bunch of, I'm going to do a big porchetta, we'll do a prime rib roast, we'll do like a sauerbraten, and just go from there.
And Christian, speaking of that now, because this is a huge day for restaurants, if anyone wants to come to Resto, is there, and even Cannibals, should they call ahead?
Yeah, I mean, Resto's, we're doing a large format feast at Resto, so actually we're doing in the spirit of the large format feast, we're going to take a half a cow and actually break that down and do a whole feast. The Cannibal will probably, you know, both of the places are going to be, we'll do early turns in both places, early reservations, but mainly the 9 o'clock time is what we're going to do. And that's like a ticket only, you know, sell it. It's open bar, it's open food, and it just sort of becomes a party. I mean, it's like dress up, not too fancy, but have a good time and feel like you can dine with your friends. And we typically open up like 9 liters of beer and big bottles of champagne.
Good, and it's good beer.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think Miller makes a 9 liter. I mean, I hope Miller's not a sponsor here.
Well, is it large parties? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, most people come as a group. You know, I mean, it's typically, you know, in years past, we've basically done this at Resto every year. So it's, you know, typically you do like 6 and 8 and 10 people do it at a time, and you know, you get a group of friends and you come down and it's 9, so you just sort of have a party until the ball drops and then you drink afterwards, and then, you know, it's, that's sort of it. Most people go on their way after like 1, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mike, what was like an influence in chefs? I think we talked about it, but like, is there a specific guy that kind of was I've asked you this before actually when we were working, and I don't think there was an actual name, but is there anyone that comes to mind that
Definitely try to take something from everybody you've worked with. Yeah. And in my time in New York City, like working at Enoteca with Eric Kleinman and, I mean, Jason Denton, like great influence as far as like both business and operations and also in the kitchen. Beyond that, I mean, like I spent some time with Del Anima. Gabe was awesome to work with, and he was always a very cool, grounded guy that was very easy to work with and very easy to talk to. And just, it was never all business. It was always just like, you need to have this mix of personality, like this mix of education for your staff, this mix of, you know, training people and learning from people every day. Who I would say he was a very big influence on me in the last few years specifically. And I mean, also working with like Keith McNally at Polino's for a brief period of time was a very, you know, good influence as far as a business operation standpoint.
How about my procurement skills? Did you learn anything from how, you know, thanks again, guys. You're in studio for the rest of the show.
Awesome.
But I respect you guys a lot. We talked at the Eater Awards, and you know, here we are now. We're going to take a break. We're going to, you know, it's Sunday. Two things happen on Sundays. It's Meet the Press on Sunday, and also it's the morning after. We're going to talk to Assemblyman Matthew Tone, and we're going to talk to a guy doing some radical charcuterie out there.
Barman poet. Give us a kiss, you sexy beast! I see America drinking the fabulous cocktails I make. America's getting stinking on something I stir or shake. The sex on the beach. The schnapps made from peach. The velvet hammer. The Alabama slammer. I make things with juice and froth, the pink squirrel, the three-toed sloth. I make drinks so sweet and snazzy, the iced tea, the kamikaze, the orgasm.
Oh, hands up the merchandise.
The death spasm. The Singapore sling, the ding-a-ling. America, you're just devoted.
And we're back, morning after. Wow, there's a lot of power playing in here. I feel like I'm on K Street right now. There's cards being passed back and forth. we're going to go first, before we speak to the assemblyman, to a gentleman I met at Patrick Martin's butcher shop on Essex Street. I don't know if anyone gets a chance to make it down there, but it's definitely a place you got to check out. Especially for, just so you know, this is actually free advice I'm giving in the procurement world. Patrick Martin's has an entire walk-in box of heritage pork in Essex Market. So if you're a little lazy and you forget to call something in, or you get shorted by a purveyor, of course not Pat LaFrieda, someone else, you can call Patrick Martin's at the Essex Market, and he probably has that particular picnic shoulder or you know, Canadian in there, definitely. And this gentleman's name is Charles Wixelbaum. He's owner of Charlito's Cochina. That's not one of the guys that sued Facebook, right? No, that was Winklevoss. Sorry, I'm missing my things up. Are you there, Charles?
Yeah, I'm right here.
What's up, man? So we met, and you handed me what I thought was like a salumi, but it was actually like a fig, a date salumi. What was that thing you handed me?
Yeah, I handed you what we call the dried fruit salami, and the one that happened to be was made out of figs. What we do is we take dried figs, we mix it up with a little bit of red wine and a splash of bourbon, and then we put it in like a parchment paper type of casing. And with like a little netting around it, we package it like a regular salami, and then we let it dry out for a little bit, and it ripens, and it functions much like a cereal meat salami, where in that it gets better with age, it loses some of its moisture, and the flavors really develop, and they goes really nicely with, you know, a real salami, for example, also great on a cheese platter.
So and And it also has the guise of looking like meat. So if you want to have a, you know, a party and sort of trick everybody, you can kind of do the entire thing in that section. So, you know, you write a business plan, you raise money, and then you decide to go into curing meats, which is not the most predictable kind of outcome. You kind of have to do it a few times. How long did it take you to get to, say, to shipping, you know, in terms of to customers?
Oh, it took us about, I'd say about a year and a half, between when we decided to do this and we shipped our first order. So, it took a little bit of time, but we finally got there.
Now, I know your stuff is available at the Heritage Meat Shop on Essex, but you're just kind of getting out there with restaurants and stuff. If anyone's listening, well, a lot of restaurant people listen to the show. Should I go on the website to get in touch with you?
Yeah, definitely. Check us out on our website. You can email me directly. Actually, that year and a half period that I gave you is just now ending, so we're just starting to get into stores and restaurants, like you said. We're actually selling at the Columbus Circle Holiday Market up at Columbus Circle in Manhattan. We have a booth there where we're selling our black truffle salami.
Which I tried, which is awesome. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. And we're also selling our chorizo. We're selling some lardo up there. We're doing the fruit salamis, too. We have the whole line for sale here in our booth. If you're around the area, check us out. And we also just got into a couple of stores, actually, one in Connecticut and one down in Virginia, which is, you can see on our website, too. So, we're getting the wheels in motion. And so, we're ready to go now.
Well, thanks a lot, man. I want to wish you the best of luck. We just serendipitously ran into each other on Tuesday, and I was really excited because I know how tough it is, one, to start a business, and then, two, like, to go into what you're doing. So, I think you mind checking in this spring and see where we're at in terms of the company and how much you guys have grown?
Yeah, I would love to. I would love that. I mean, I'm a big fan of Heritage Radio Network, and Patrick over at Heritage Foods has been a real ally of mine. You know, I couldn't do this without a guy like him, so... been great having them as partners.
Well, thanks a lot. Do me a favor, just go up to Per Se and tell Tommy Keller I said what's up. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I will.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on the show.
Anytime, man. I just want everyone that's, there's a lot of industry people that listen to this, but the non-industry people that listen to this, I want them to hear, how much time people that work in this business do. And I want everyone to know when we're not flying in, private jets or, we don't have luxurious cars or anything. Pat LaFrieda, who is probably one of the top... purveyors of meat in the country, the guy works a 70-hour work week. He probably, doesn't need to do it at this point in time, but to have the amount of control and in the positive way of control of the final product, actually meat. You cannot be there for 2 days and your entire assembly line with stuff could be thrown off. There's not a specific fixed thing that finite thing that happens in our business. You have to be there all the time, no matter how successful you are. And speaking of difficult businesses, we're gonna go into the political realm of stuff. We're not get too political, but this is a gentleman who came across a friend whose name is Chris Bauer, and he worked for the Staten Island AIDS Task Force. And I met Chris many years ago when I was a barback at the Cargo Cafe. And New York State Assemblyman Matthew Tutone is in studio right now. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
How do you like Roberta's?
I am salivating because you have the big window here, and I'm seeing people eating the pizza and all different things. I looked at the menu before coming here, and then the cannibal talking about. So I'm salivating. I'm famished.
Well, I'm also salivating. Looking at what you brought from your garden.
Yes,
we have some Italian fryer peppers here, and these things are still going on right now in December.
Gotta love the global warming.
I pocket vetoed that vote when it came through on the whole global warming thing. But now, all kidding aside, when we spoke, we actually both graduated from the same high school, Monsignor Farrell High School.
Different times, yes. Enough said about that, though, Jason, right?
once we spoke about that, we also said brought up Snug Harbor, and it was a great project that you remember the board there as well, right?
Well, I was until I got elected. Then Well, technically, I would be allowed to. I wouldn't be allowed to fund Snug Harbor, so I resigned after my election. But yeah, the sustainable farm, or the heritage farm, as it's technically called, is one of a kind, the first of its kind, certainly in the United States, and most likely in the entire world, the planet. And what it is, it's basically a not-for-profit farm that is sustainable in the sense that some certain portion of the produce that's harvested will go to the commercial market for retail, and another percentage will go to the feeding of the food banks throughout Staten Island, which there's such a great need, particularly for healthy, you know, fresh vegetables, which you don't see in the food banks. You typically see the canned goods, boxed cereals, and things of that nature.
Well, someone, we were having a conversation about that exact thing, which was heritage turkeys, or, you know, and the idea that they're $3 or $4 more, and saying, you know, I don't want to get too political, but just saying the idea of giving somebody who maybe can't, you know, afford that, that they can buy it, but it's not probably, it's probably best for them to buy the more commodity based stuff. But it's more nutritious to buy the $3 or $4 one. What is
absolutely
that?
But here's the thing, Jason. When you look at minority neighborhoods, the poor neighborhoods throughout not only New York City but New York State, the accessibility of fresh produce simply is not there. So what we're going to be doing with the farm at Snook Harbor is making sure, ensuring that our low-income, our poor folks on Staten Island have nutritious food, fresh, nutritious vegetables.
And who's this gentleman sitting to your right here?
That's my good friend, my buddy. That's the program director of Snook Harbor Cultural Center and Botanical Gardens, Larry Anderson, who is coming up with all the programming at the farm, because not only will it be used to provide food to our restaurants as well as our low-income families, but also it'll have a magnificent educational components to it.
Can you say hello?
Hey, how are you guys doing?
No, thank you for coming out. And we were kind of going back and forth, and you guys just came sort of last minute. We were going to do a call, and I totally appreciate, you know, you coming down.
It's fortuitous.
So there's programs going on. If you have a child, you want to sort of teach them how to garden and stuff.
One of the most interesting things we've discovered is that most kids today, if you show them a tomato, a whole tomato, they have no idea what it is.
Yeah.
Once you slice it, oh, I know what that is.
That's
a tomato.
So weird.
They have no idea where it comes from. And your earlier guests were talking about rediscovering the roots of, you know, of butchering and using a whole animal. We're trying to teach kids to rediscover the roots of farming and where things come from and how they, you know, get on your plate, so to speak. So it'll be a dual-purpose program where we'll not only, you know, do good for the folks that don't have access to fresh vegetables and fresh produce, provide them with that, but at the same time we'll be educating people about how you get there. And the neat thing about it is Snook Harbor had farms back in the day. It was a self-contained,
well, they built that bridge.
The sailors had a self-contained farm, you know, they grew their own produce, and we're actually taking it back to the original roots of what went on.
It's basically a wink and a nod to the history.
It is.
And I just want to point out with the educational component, when you talk about children, there are several studies which indicate and exhibit that when you teach a child how to grow a plant, they're more likely, 90% more likely to make a healthy food choice independently of an adult. They're more likely to try a zucchini if they've never had one before. They're more likely to try a Brussels sprout if they've never had one. So when we talk about the educational component, it's also a lifestyle education, making those healthy choices, that you don't need to go to a fast food restaurant and have their salad when you can grow and make your own and get better nutrition.
Wow. And speaking of better or bad nutrition, pizzerias. So we're at Roberta's right now, and I don't. We won't say one place, but I'm guessing because of where your constituency is, what you might say. But in terms of Staten Island, a couple of pizzerias that for myself, it's Lee's Tavern. But I don't know.
I love Lee's, but I'm more of a Danino's guy.
I knew it. And I'm kidding.
But I want to point out, you know, we talk about Staten Island, and people automatically assume that it's all pizzerias, Italian food, when we have one of the finest Mexican restaurants in all of New York City. We have a great German restaurant.
What are the names?
Maisel on Bay Street. It's the type of place, if you go there looking for a frozen margarita, you simply will not get it, but they will tell you that we will make you a real margarita. German restaurants, we have one of the largest Sri Lankan populations outside of Sri Lanka, so you have amazing Sri Lankan restaurants. We have the largest Liberian population outside of Liberia, so you have amazing African food, a soul food. So it's not just Italian food
no,
on
no,
Staten
I,
Island.
I know. No, it's
we also have Chinese restaurants. Do you want to add that?
Well, yeah, so Lum Chin's or one of my favorite places is not there anymore. But no, it's totally. It's Staten Island is you know is. There's a lot going on. It's sad, myself being an Italian American, kind of growing up, and all these sort of stereotypes that have come towards me, coming from Staten Island, all the things that I have to like fight against
but
my
yeah,
entire
but
life.
Yeah, we get it. We get it. We know how extraordinarily diverse Staten Island is, and we go out and we cross the bridge or take the ferry, and people just have their preconceived notions of what Staten Island might be, thanks to, you know, I guess the Jersey Shore, the mob wives. But
yeah, we're not Gavones.
Right, we're not Gavones.
Jason, by the way, that's a really great tracksuit you're wearing today. I just want to make sure to point that out.
Well, actually, this is this is Sergio Tacchini, actually. Yeah. Vintage Sergio Tacchini. But I have one more question for you, and we're going to end the show. One is, you know, congratulations, you were just recently married, but if you're on a perfect date and you're coming off of the Staten Island ferry from either one of you know the other boroughs, and you get off the ferry, give me two or three places that to check out.
First of all, I would highly recommend that you first go to Snug Harbor, which is actually you could take a bicycle there. There's public transportation. You could even walk to it. Snug Harbor, 83 acres of cultural institutions. You have the John Noble Maritime Museum there. You have the Children's Museum there. You have the Newhouse Galleries of Contemporary Art, which are renowned. Internationally, the New York Times called one of the exhibits there perhaps one of the most important exhibits in the history of New York City. What else is there? The Staten Island Institute
Staten
of Arts
Museum. And, we've got the New York Chinese Scholars Garden and the Sustainable Farm, where you can actually see food and produce being grown.
So
in,
I mean,
in real time.
Yes.
So right there, you know, you have a day right there. From there, I would head back to the ferry. But before getting on to the ferry, I'd make a little detour up on Hyatt Street and check out Anateca Maria, which is, okay, it's an Italian restaurant, but you never know.
Assemblyman, I want to, wait, can we retract to go back 2 minutes?
Well,
did you not just say?
Take them to Basil.
But I do want to point out that you'll never know what region of Italy you'll be eating from when you go to Anateca, because every other week there's a new nonna or grandmother that cooks. So 1 week you could be eating Northern Italian, the next week you're eating Sicilian.
Yeah, and this is covered, and actually the New York Times picked up an article on this, and you can Google that. But I want to thank everyone today for coming out. I know, you know, Sundays are a pretty hard day for people with football, and, you know, especially, you know, you were in Albany all week, right?
Yes.
What, is that?
Lowering your taxes.
Well, there we go. On that note, this is The Morning After. I'm Jason Colucci. If anyone wants to tune in, they can hit it on iTunes. They can check it out on theheritageradionetwork.com. See you next week. This 97, I my niggas and my niggas. Let's do it like this. I'm going to rub your ass in the moonshine. Let's take it back to 79. I bomb atomically. Socrates, philosophies, and hypotheses. Can't define how I be dropping these mockeries. Lyrically perform armed robbery. Flee with the lottery. Possibly they spotted me. Battle scarred shogun. Explosion when my pen hits. Tremendous. Ultraviolet shine blind forensics. I inspect view through the future. See millennium. Killer bees sold 50 gold, 60 platinum.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.